about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring David Edenson. He'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the Golden Isle. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask David a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you are there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed when we have new shows. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with David Edens about fly fishing the Golden Isle. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish and flora and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters today and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to the website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Before we introduce David, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under David's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Saltwater Fly Fishing from Maine to Texas, courtesy of Amato Books. And you can find out more about the books and publications Amato has at amatobooks.com. Now, here's how you can win that book. First, you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer, along with your name and location, using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and see if you can't win that book. Now, tonight, our guest is Captain David Edens. David has been fly fishing and tying flies for over 45 years. When he began tying, he would pluck the family dog and cat for fur for streamers and rob his mom's sewing box for thread. His first fly-caught fish was a wild rainbow trout caught on a variant of a Mickey Finn he had tied with fur from the family pets. He caught it from a stream to which he had ridden his bike, a la Opie in the Andy Griffith Show. We all remember that. Since those early years, David has fly-fished for trout, steelhead, stripers, salmon, false albacore, bonefish, permit, tarpon, redfish, triple tail, sea trout, bream, carp, bass, and anything else that would take a fly from Alaska to the Bahamas, from Vermont to California and many of the states in between. He is an Orvis-endorsed fly fishing guide. He is a Federation of Fly Fishers certified casting instructor and a member of the FFF Professional Guides Association. He has been building custom fly, spinning, and casting rods for over 15 years under Blue Ridge Rods and has been certified by the Rod Guild as a professional rod builder. David is the owner of Flycast Charters and Outfitters in St. Simons, Georgia. The tagline of the charter service is Hunting Fish in the Marshes of Glynn. He specializes in sight fishing for redfish and is available for fly and light tackle charters for all of the other species around St. Simons Island, Sea Island, Cumberland Island, and Jekyll Island in Georgia. Well, David, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, it's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I look forward to sharing a little bit of what I know about fly fishing in and around the Golden Isles of Georgia.
Well, that's great. That's great. Now, that's an area I have not been to, and so I'm gonna learn a lot tonight too. Now, let's just start at the beginning. We do have an international audience, and so why don't you explain to us where Golden Isles are?
The Golden Isles of Georgia are a series of barrier islands right off the Georgia coast. It's comprised of Little St. Simons, Sea Island, St. Simons, Jekyll Island, and Cumberland Island. Cumberland Island is the last barrier island before you get to Florida. St. Simons is more or less is a small town. It's kind of a resort community. On the island of St. Simons, it's about 5 miles across the marshes from the city of Brunswick. We're located about 1 hour north of the Jacksonville Airport and about an hour and a half south of Savannah. So, you know, we're pretty far south. And also, if you look at St. Simons, we're pretty far west because we're at the westernmost point of the South Atlantic Bight. And I'll get into why that's significant later. It's a beautiful area. We have hundreds of thousands of marshes. We've got several rivers that feed the area that make it one of the most fertile breeding grounds and fertile marsh complexes in the southeastern United States, Roger.
And why is the area called the Golden Isle?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I don't know which one is really true or not. In the fall, let me back up. We have miles and miles of Spartina grass flats here. The causeway from Brunswick, the mainland, to St. Simons is four and a half miles long. And on either side, there's really Spartina grass flats as far as you can see. And in the fall and the winter, these turn to a golden tan color, and it's really quite pretty as you drive across the causeway. So some people say that that's the reason, because of the golden tan of the Spartina grass. I like to think sometimes, maybe in the winter particularly, it's for the golden sunsets that we have. And some people say it's because of the gold that Blackbeard, the pirate, possibly buried here centuries ago. So who knows? It's just a beautiful part of the state of Georgia. It's not populated at all. We're in southeast Georgia, and, you know, southeast Georgia is nothing but a bunch of pine trees.
Well, hopefully all those reasons it's called the Golden Isles are true. You know? That makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all these stories about hidden treasure, you know, and I guess once in a while they do find some down in the Caribbean, so it's not all stories. So.
So there was a story recently about somebody found some gold doubloons off the Florida coast. I mean, this was quite recently, but anyway.
No, yeah.
I don't know of anybody that's found pirate treasure around here.
No, you sure haven't, huh?
No, I'm still working for a living.
You're still working for a living, okay.
Yeah.
So what, you kind of alluded to this a minute ago, but what makes coast where the Golden Isles are different than the rest of the Georgia coast?
I think what makes our area, and let me just kind of concentrate on the fishery aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what makes our area a little different, and, you know, the Georgia coast is really actually quite beautiful, but we're located away from major population centers. Like I said, Jacksonville, of over a million people, is you know, hour and a half south of us. People live down in Jacksonville. They have Florida fishing licenses, so they don't come up here very often. We're an hour and a half south of Savannah, and there's really no major metro area between us and Savannah. It's really undeveloped coastline. So primarily, I think it's the lack of the fishing pressure, particularly when it comes to the fly fishers. You can go to Charleston or Beaufort, and on the flood tides, it's hard sometimes to find a flat that hadn't been worked or doesn't have somebody wading on it looking for tail and redfish. Here, it's unusual to see somebody else on a flat. There's one particular flat I fished on the last set of flood tides we had in June, I believe, and fished it for 4 years and never seen anybody else on it. And I was really dismayed when I saw one other person on this 1,000-acre, you know, whatever, 200-acre, ever how big it is, this huge, huge flat. So you don't have the competition, particularly if you're a fly fisherman, and particularly if you concentrate on the shallow water side fishing.
Right.
There are a lot of people that fish here. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the barrier islands kind of break up the coast, right, and create that flats habitat that you don't get on a direct coast that
yeah,
directly
that's right.
Contacts
yeah.
the ocean, right?
Yeah, that's right. Like, you know, almost all up and down the East Coast, from New Jersey down to Florida, The ocean is, or the mainland is bounded by a series of barrier islands. And it's the, and behind the barrier islands, particularly here in Georgia, you've got these big marsh complexes that build up. And it's the marsh complexes that are really the nursery ground of the oceans, which is why they're so doggone important. The health of them is so doggone important. I mean, that's where the shrimp spawn offshore, the eggs come in and they mature in the marshes. You know, the redfish spawn offshore, the eggs come in and they mature in the marshes, and the sea trout mature in the marshes, and the croakers mature in the marshes, and, you know, the marshes, the big marsh complex really gives us a tremendous amount of biodiversity, I guess you would say. And in this area, we have a couple of major rivers that come in. We have the Satilla River, which drains southeast Georgia. We have the Altamaha River, which really drains most of central Georgia. It starts up in the Athens, Georgia area, and which is like 60 miles east of Atlanta with the Oconee River, and the Oconee River is in the Altamaha River drainage. So these rivers wash tons of nutrients down into the salt marsh flats, and it just makes for, there's a lot for fish to eat here, I guess is what you would say.
Now that those rivers, the drainage, have there been? I know in a lot of areas, you know, because of nitrogen and so forth, agricultural areas, they have problems with, you know, things coming down into the ocean or lakes or something. Is there any problem with that in these rivers?
You know, there's always a concern about the pollution, but not really.
Good.
You know, not really. Occasionally, there's a, you know, a sewage plant upstream is going to overflow, but they carry so much volume down here. And there's really, the last 100 miles, they don't flow through any populated areas. You know, South Georgia is, you know, they like to say there's a whole lot of nothing down here. And, I mean, that's really true. There's a whole lot of nothing down here. I mean, you can drive for miles and miles and miles between even the small towns. So
wow.
you just don't have the people impact. One of the really interesting things, I wanted to mention this about the Georgia coast, it's probably one of the more undeveloped coasts on the east coast. There are only four barrier islands, and I think there are a total of 15 barrier islands on Georgia, but there are only, I believe it's four, and I'll count them out in a minute, that are accessible by automobile. One is Tybee, which is more or less a suburb of Savannah, and it's accessible by automobile. And the next one you have is St. Simon. So you've got, what, 80 miles, 70 miles of coastline? Yeah, at least 70 miles of coastline where the barrier islands are not accessible by automobile. The only way you can get to them is by boat. And many of them are wildlife sanctuaries. For example, starting at the south here, you've got Cumberland Island, Jekyll Island, St. Simon's Sea Island, Little St. Simon's, and then Wolf Island and Sapelo Island. And Sapelo Island is primarily a marine reserve. Wolf Island is a wildlife refuge. Little St. Simon's is privately owned, and it has a very nice eco-oriented lodge on it. Those islands are not accessible by automobile. You can only get to those by boat. The other islands that are accessible by automobile are St. Simon's, Sea Island, and Jekyll Island. Those are the only three areas that you can get to by automobile.
That keeps
sea
the
Island
people
is
out.
Private. It does. Sea Island is private. You've got the, it's a very exclusive resort with very high-end homes, and you've got to be a property owner or be invited onto the island to get past the security. So that's pretty much shut out. And then you've got St. Simon's, and I think we limit the height of buildings here on St. Simon's to no more than three stories. And then south of us, you have Jekyll, which is the other island that is accessible by automobile. It's primarily a state park. There are some privately owned residences on the northern end of the island, and the state does allow some hotel and commercial developments down there. In fact, they just approved the construction of a Westin Hotel, and they did a new convention center. But you don't have any of the high-rise development on the Georgia coast like you have in Florida. Or you don't have the crowded development like you have in Atlantic Beach in North Carolina. And south of us, south of Jekyll, is Cumberland Island. It's a, it's 16, 18 miles long, I think. And it's primarily a marine reserve as well. It's a combination of federal and state. And it's only accessible by ferry from St. Mary's. And if you want to go over there and camp, you've got to get a special permit. There are a couple of nice hotels on it, but they're located on the backside of the island. And Cumberland Island has got to be one of the most beautiful barrier islands on the coast. Christmas Creek is a creek that empties into the ocean side, and you can great fishing down there, by the way. And you can pull into Christmas Creek, and you're surrounded by sand dunes on the ocean side and marsh on the land side, and there are wild ponies down there, and there are eagles, and you drive down in a boat down along the coast, and it's nothing but a series of sand dunes and sea oats. I mean, we're so blessed in Georgia to not have the development that some of the other states have. And to me, that's what makes it so special. You can stand on Pelican Spit, which is a sandbar between Sea Island and Little St. Simons, and you would think that you're in some far remote place. It's really amazing. It's really amazing.
Sounds great. Yeah, sounds beautiful. Well, tell us about the kind of fish that we can target in the Golden Islands.
I fish primarily inshore, a little bit of near shore, but not a lot. My specialty is sight fishing for redfish, which is what I find most fly fishers want to do in this part of the world, and where we literally, I pull them around through shallow water, and we look for the fish, and then we take our shots at the fish. It's a sight fishing thing. It's difficult to do, but seems like what most people want to do. We have the option of catching speckled sea trout, which is primarily a blind casting thing. You blind cast the oyster rakes. Occasionally, we'll get shots at black drum on the flats, and that's a pretty sporty fish. And we actually, on the flood tides and on some of the oyster mounds, you'll see sheep's head that are tailing. And that's quite a trophy on a fly rod. A lot of people call them a grass permit. They're so hard to catch on a fly rod. But they're a lot of fun when you do. We caught one last year. I was more excited about my client catching that one sheep's head than I was about the free redfish that he caught.
Are those the same sheep heads that you'll find on the Pacific Coast? I remember sheep head being around Santa Barbara when I was diving.
Not sure. These have bars on them, they've got bars on them like convict bars, striped convict uniform. People call them convict fish sometimes. I don't know if they're the same fish or not.
Yeah, interesting.
But, a lot of people around here fish for sharks. Flounder fishing is great right now. Oh, a really unique fishery we have is going on right now, and I should have mentioned this earlier. We get these schools of big Jack Crevalle, and I'm talking 30-pound Jack Crevalle, that come into the St. Simon Sound about this time of year. And they're swimming around in small schools, and they're high in the water, and you can see them slashing at bait, and they don't do a whole lot of that unless they're working a bait ball, and typically what we're fishing for are not working a bait ball. They're just swimming high in the water, and you see their fins out of the water. And it's a sight fishing thing in 30 feet of water, but it's a hoot. And I hooked and landed a 30-pound Jack Crevalle 2 days ago on an 11-weight fly rod, and I felt lucky to bring him in within 15 minutes. They are a strong
fish. Huh?
Strong fish. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also
a
tarpon fishery here. The tarpon fishery is beginning to fire up right now. Primarily an oceanside fishery. They have caught a few in the Hampton River, which runs between Sea Island, St. Simons, and Little St. Simons. They have caught a few offshore. Most of those are caught in the ocean, 1 to 3 miles offshore. Primarily a bait fishery, but a few are caught on a fly rod every year. I personally have never done it, but I have some other captains here that have that have done it. So, you know, it's a tarpon, shark, redfish, trout, flounder. I would say those are the primary species that we target.
So the best thing to do is to call you or another guide in the area to find out what's happening at certain times of the year, because it sounds like some of this is seasonal, right?
It's all seasonal, man.
Yeah,
it's very seasonal. The redfish go off all year, but they have different patterns at different times of the year.
Let's take a quick break here, David, and then we'll come back and talk about that. More about the redfish in particular. So we'll be right
Sounds good, folks.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. It's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with David Edens about fly fishing Golden Isles. If you'd like to ask David a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, I'm just checking a few things here, David, to see what... We had any questions come in yet? But let's before we jump into redfish and talking more about those, tell us a bit about what's going on in your fly fishing world. Tell us about your business and if you're involved in any other aspects of fly fishing down in southern Georgia.
Okay. Gosh, my business, it's essentially a guide service. As I said, I specialize in sight fishing for redfish. I fish on the various tides at various times of years. We try to concentrate. We fish at different tide levels, so we don't always start at 6:30 in the morning. For example, we're starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning because the low tide is at 11, and we're going to be sight fishing the low tide for redfish. In Georgia, speaking of redfish, the state legislature just gave the redfish game fish status in the state, which means it can no longer be sold, which means there's going to be a little bit less pressure on it. That's a really good thing. A lot of the guides and a lot of the conservation people worked really hard to convince the legislature to name the game fish, to give the redfish game fish status in the state. One of the things that I enjoy doing the most is helping people learn how to fly cast. For years and years and years, I was fishing little small streams and where loop control didn't matter, and eventually learned when I started warm water fishing how important loop control was and how important the cast was. And being down here in the salt water, it's even more important. And I really enjoy doing the fly casting instruction. Attended the Southeastern Conclave of the FFF a few weeks ago. And not only did I give a class on accuracy, I took a class on distance casting. And, you know, you're always learning in this sport. There's always something to do. And I learned there were about three or four things that I was doing wrong, and I was able to fix that. So it was nice to work with someone else on my casting, which makes me a better instructor as well. So I enjoy doing that a lot. Then, you know, we're just fishing real hard right now. What can I say?
Yeah. What
the fish
you have
are here?
Website,
yes, it's www.flycastcharters.com.
Flycastcharters.com.
Flycastcharters.com.
Mm-hmm. People want to get a hold of you, contact you, that's the place to go.
That's right? The best way to do it. Send me an email, flycastcharters@gmail.com. Call me on the telephone, site. We've got some great tides.
Do you want to drop your telephone number?
Yeah, area code. Yeah, it's a cell phone number is best. That would be area code 706-540-1276. That's 706-540-1276.
Great, great.
That's the best Terrific. Way to reach me. Yeah. Terrific. And I'll be on the water tomorrow, so you can call in the afternoon.
Okay.
do want to say, we've got some great flood tides coming up beginning on Friday and going through about next week. And the flood tides happen on the new and the full moons, and we're coming up onto a full moon. And the flood tides are where our Spartina grass flats flood, and the redfish get up into the Spartina grass, this is where we really have our classic southern tailing redfishing fishing. The fish are nose down grubbing in the marsh for fiddler crabs, and their tails are waving in the air. And you can see them from 50 yards away. It's probably the most visual, exciting way to fish for the fish, and it's really the classic southern fly fishing for redfish that most people think about.
And that happens every time there's, would you say, a full moon?
Typically, full or a new moon.
Say
we've
got to
have tides typically on a new or a full moon. We've got to have tides over 7.3 feet at the St. Simon's Bar.
Okay.
And you got to time it to the tides, and that's another thing that's really important fishing down here. Tides, like for these redfish tides, for the tailing tides, we'll have easily a 9, possibly a 10-foot tidal change during a 6-hour period.
Now, you had mentioned the rivers coming into the coast there. Do those affect your fishing? I mean, you talked about bringing food and nutrients down into the water. Does it affect where you fish, or are those places that you target? Or?
It really can, because of the amount of water that they bring in. A lot of times, particularly if there's been flooding up in North Georgia or heavy rains in Southwest Georgia, they'll dump an awful lot of fresh water into the marsh. While that's not bad for the marsh itself, it does make particularly the trout move around some. It makes the fish move around some and it makes the shrimp move around some. The trout and the redfish can adapt to a brackish water or even more fresh than salt, but the shrimp can't. And the shrimp will move around, and the shrimp are bait. And where the shrimp are, that's where the fish are. Also, torrents of water will tend to make our waters even muddier than they normally are. They've got a real negative impact on the fishery too. But it only lasts for a few days or maybe a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Is that when the large volume of water, is that a spring runoff kind of thing like we experience out west?
No, it's not a spring runoff. We don't get any type of snow or anything here to do a spring runoff. It's usually caused by a tropical
storm.
Or a low pressure system camping out over North Georgia or something like that.
Okay. So redfish is the game as far as you're concerned down there, and that's what you target with your clients. What's a trophy redfish in that area? What size do they get, and what's an average size that you catch?
Yeah, I'd say the average size of the fish we catch is anywhere between 5 and 6 pounds.
Okay.
you got to understand the life cycle of a redfish. We fish inshore. Anything 30 inches, 10 pounds or over, in my book, is a trophy fish inshore. Now, these fish, like I said earlier, the eggs wash into the marsh, and they grow, and they mature in the marsh. So all the fish that we're catching in the marsh are sexually immature. Once they reach about 30, 32 inches, these fish become sexually mature, and they move offshore, where they can grow to 50 pounds, 60 pounds, but they never come back inshore. They do come near, a lot of people do target them, particularly in October, but it's strictly a sport thing because anything over 23 inches in the state of Georgia has got to be released. I mean, that's the future of our fishery. That's the spawning stock right there.
Right.
So, I mean, they'll catch 30 and 40 pound fish in the ocean in the fall and in the spring when they come in to spawn, but I'm not going to say never, but it's highly, highly unusual to catch one like that inshore.
Now, are these people
10,
catching
12, 14, 10, 12, 14 pounds is a real trophy redfish inshore.
These nearshore catches that you just talked about, are those on the fly or are those on bait casting?
Primarily bait.
You
can, in October, you can do some surf fishing with a fly rod for them. Not many people do. It's a lot of casting.
Yeah, A lot of blind casting.
A lot of blind casting, yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of explained, I guess, in general, my next question, which had to do with spawning and migration activity. But they're really, other than the mature fish going out to sea, there really is not much of a migration going back and forth, right?
Absolutely not. The redfish grow up with usually within a few miles of where their eggs hatch. They usually don't move out of that general area. I mean, there's some of them I think I've caught so often that I know their name. I'm kidding, but we fish the same, you know, the same schools and the same fish. They don't move around very much.
Does we had a question come from Tim Baer in Central Illinois. He says, are there better times of year to be fishing for redfish due to catchability or crowds, he says, but we already determined you don't have crowds. So So are there better times of year for redfish than others?
Well, I always like to say the best time to go fishing is when you can.
Guides always say that, David.
I catch fish year-round. If I were... Okay. To have to give my favorite times of year to fish, it would probably be August and September and early October on the flood tides, where, as I talked about earlier, on the new moons and the full moons, when we have the fish come inshore, I mean, when the fish go up into the marsh and they're grubbing for fiddler crabs and you see their tails waving in the air. I have a... video of doing that on my website that'll come up. It's flycastcharters.com. It's just really exciting. And in August and September and in October, we actually get some... If you ever look at a tide chart, you'll see tides are normally higher in the evening than they are in the morning. If we can get a tide high enough in the morning, and we get those in August, September, and October, and we actually have some coming up next week. They're going to be marginal, but they're going to be, as long as the wind doesn't blow from the west, they'll be fine. You can get there first thing in the morning, and it's slick calm, and you can see these fish tailing from, you know, from 100 yards away, and you're in the boat, and you pull the boat to them, and you cast at them, and your casts have got to be accurate. It's so much fun. The other times of year... November and December, when the weather starts getting colder, our water clears, and on the nip tides, it's a great time to sight fish for these fish because we're looking at clear water. We're looking at water that's typically as clear as Mosquito Lagoon is clear, and the fish are in big schools. They're schools 20, 50, 100 fish at that time of year. In the wintertime, they get into really big schools of fish. And November, December, usually it's not too cold down here yet. If you can catch one of the bluebird days, you know, 2 or 3 days after a front's moved through and 2 or 3 days before the next front moves through and it's calm, it can be amazing. Several times this last year, last winter, we had those days and I had clients. I mean, if you catch 4 or 5 redfish on a tide, on a charter, you've had an exceptional charter, and we did that a couple of times. Then in February, January and February, that pattern continues, and the schools get bigger and bigger and bigger. There's a good and the bad to that. The good is that when you find the fish, you really find a lot of fish. The bad is that the fish are not everywhere. I mean, there are only X number of fish in the area, and if they're bunched up into big schools, you got to find the big schools before you find the fish. So a lot of times you got to move around and pull a long way and try different spots before you find the fish. Although usually they hang out within 100 yards of a spot. But I'm digressing. What I wanted to make a point of was the end of February last year, this year, I was out with a client, and we saw. Literally saw a school of redfish pushing through shallow water. The tide was going out. They were moving out with the tide, at least 50 yards wide and 25 yards deep. I have no idea how many fish were in that school. We managed to catch two out of them before we spooked it. But it's amazing. The wintertime fishery down here can be absolutely amazing. On the other hand, if you're down here at the wrong time, if you're down here the day after a major cold front pushes through when the wind's blowing 25 miles an hour from the northeast, first of all, it's dangerous to go out. Second of all, I wouldn't want to go out. And thirdly, you're not going to catch any fish. So, you know,
that's always kind of the luck of the draw down there in Georgia and Florida, especially. Where you can plan your whole trip perfectly, and you get down there, and the wind's blowing like hell, and fishing's off and terrible, or you can't go out.
It was like the 1st of March, somebody turned the fans on, and I think we're just going to turn them off the next few days. It's been blowing forever. I'm so tired of wind. Looking forward
that's part
to
of what goes on
southwest
with
winds for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's part of fishing on the salt, though, right? There's always wind, basically.
No question about it. You got to know how to handle it. Much over 15 miles an hour, 18, 20 miles an hour, it really gets tough. And there's really not much I can do because I can't control the skiff on a pole in that kind of wind either. I'll do my best, but really tough.
Casting isn't too much fun either at that point.
No, it's not. And I do my best to keep my client upwind, but there's only so much you can do sometimes.
Well, let's take another quick break, and we'll come back and talk more about the Golden Isles.
Okay.
Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. They're located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Okay, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with David Edens about fly fishing the Golden Isles. If you'd like to ask David a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, we did get a couple of questions in here on the internet, David. Philip in Calabasas wants to know what the fees are down there for guide service. How do most of the guides charge, and is it half day, full day? What are the rates?
It varies by guide, but I'm probably average or maybe a little on the high side, and 4 hours is $350, 6 hours is $450, and 8 hours is $550. I don't have any upcharges in that. I don't have any bait fees if you want to fish bait. I mean, sometimes we do fish bait. I mean, if it's blowing 15, 20 miles an hour and you want to go fishing, we got to pull out the spinning rods. I supply water and ice, and on 8-hour charters, I do a deli-style lunch, too. So, you know, that's about average when you figure the extras that I supply. So $350,
what about the
$550, $4, $6, and $8.
Yeah, what about equipment, rods, reels?
I and really most all of the guides provide everything that you need. All you need to do is show up with a hat, sunscreen. Some of the guides don't provide drinks. They do provide ice, sunglasses, and an idea that you're going to have fun. The equipment that I use is all Orvis equipment, and I use the top-end Orvis equipment. I have Helios 2 fly rods, which are their new Helios fly rods. I highly recommend an 8-weight. It's kind of the best all-round fly rod for the inshore fly fishing. I have a Helios 2 11-weight, which I use on the Big Jack Crevalle, and if you get a shot a shot at a shark. And we do occasionally get shots at sharks. I had a client a week or two ago catch about a 4-foot-long bonnet head, cast sight fish to them. They'll come cruising around the flats, and you'll see their fins out. And we cast a purple passion to him, and he ate it. And I caught had a little black tip last year that ate a fly. And I have been fishing these flats, and I've seen 4- and 5-foot black tips running through it. So that's one of the reasons that I keep a heavy fly rod in the boat too. You hook a 4- or 5-foot shark on a fly rod, and you've got something.
Yeah, you got your hands full is what you got.
Yeah, and also this time of year it's the Jack Crevalle. I mean, that's like our state record is 38 pounds.
Wow.
And we're catching 30 and 33-pound Jack Crevalle. There is a legitimate shot of catching a state record Jack Crevalle on a fly rod down here this summer.
Wow, yeah. Cool, okay. There was another question that came in on the internet. I don't know how serious this is, but I'll ask it anyway, and if it's kind of off base, but maybe a concern for folks. The question is there a presence of flesh-eating bacteria on the Georgia coast? And I think this goes back to when there was some issues down there a couple years ago. I don't know if that was Georgia or Florida.
Well, there was a young lady who was on a homemade zip line in one of the rivers, and the zip line broke, and she cut herself, and she got some of this flesh-eating bacteria. But that's the only instance I know of. And I wade and swim, and I still got all my arms and legs, thank goodness.
Yeah. So nothing to be concerned about down there.
Fluke. Life is always a risk.
Oh yeah. Question from Don in Clarksville, Tennessee. He says, "Is this area?" And you've kind of talked about this already, but his question was, "Is this only accessible by motorboat, or can kayaks or canoes be used as well?" You pretty much said you have to have a boat to be fishing down there, correct?
You need a boat, but there are areas accessible by kayak and canoes, and a lot of people fish quite successfully out of kayaks around here. There is an area between St. Simons and Sea Island that's referred to as the ballpark, and it's a marsh complex. A lot of people kayak back there. Southeastern Adventures runs, I think they rent kayaks, and they also do kayak trips. So kayaking is really popular among people that will fish around here. It's kind of hard to see a redfish when you're sitting 2 feet above the ground, but it gets you out on the water and it gets you into fish. What more do you want?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. If that inhibits your sight casting abilities and locating a fish, and sounds like it does. But now they've made, I know at a bunch of the fly fishing shows and stuff recently, they're making a lot of these kind of sea kayaks that have outriggers and allow you to stand.
That's right. Yeah.
So. Maybe that's
not my thing, but I mean that's fine.
Yeah,
and for sure if you can stand up with and paddle boards. I've seen people out on the flats on paddle boards too.
Oh really?
Yeah, and that's really the stand up paddle boards.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We use those on rivers out here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really a good way to access the flooded grass flats. There's some in Jekyll. There's some you could access down here. You just got to get out and look and see where the fish are. The thing about the flooded grass fishing is the fish aren't everywhere. So if you're out looking, you need to keep going until you find fish.
Yeah. Doug in New York.
Why aren't they everywhere? I don't know. I just know they're not. I know they're where they are, but they're not everywhere.
Doug in New York wrote in, and he says he has family on Little Cumberland. And that he visits from time to time. He says he's never fished, but he does have access to a canoe. So are there good spots that would be accessible to him by Little Cumberland, or would he be better off to hire a
Absolutely
guide?
Absolutely not. There are no good spots to fish near Little Cumberland.
Really? Okay, so you're joking.
No good spots. No, uh-uh. Yeah, all he's got to do is get out around. in Christmas Creek and keep his eyes open. It's one of the best areas in the Southeast.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. But as far as getting a guide, I know, my experience in the saltwater is pretty much dismal if I don't get a guide, and a lot more fun when I do get a guide. Just because it's, especially if you're coming from, the Rocky Mountains or places where you're not used to fishing the salt, it's just too much to try to learn on your own, especially in the day or two that you might have. So I always encourage everybody to get a guide, and you'll have a lot more fun. Alan and
so much. It shortens the learning curve so much.
Yeah. You always learn something no matter what and where you are in the world. You always come out a better fly fisher.
When I go someplace else, I want to, I like to do things on my own, but I'll hire a guide the first day. And I'll tell the person, I said, I'm going to fish for the next couple of days on my own. But I'd like to fish with you this day and have you show me around, but don't be surprised if I show up tomorrow where we fished. if you do that, but seriously, be honest with the guide and let him know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of them are, I'm like really open. I really think that our resource needs a contingency. And the more people that we have behind our resource, the more powerful we'll be in terms of preserving our resource.
Right, right.
So I'm really open to helping people.
Alan Grubbs in Monroe, Georgia, wrote in and he says his folks have a place on site, St. Simons, and they too have a canoe. Do the marshes in the center of that island have much to offer? Would you suggest I go, given I have access to a paddle craft? So he's talking marshes in the center of the island. Do you want
to I think he's probably talking to that ballpark area I referred to earlier.
Oh, okay.
The marshes between Sea Island and St. Simons. Bloody Marsh. Yeah, absolutely. Get out there in the creeks, and if you don't see fish, blind cast up against the oyster banks. You'll catch something. Put a green and white size 2 clouser on it. You'll catch something.
Famous green and white clouser, huh?
Chartreuse and white. Or actually, chartreuse and pink works pretty well, too.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about equipment and flies here. You'd mentioned earlier that I think it was an 8-weight, 9-foot 8-weight. Is that your normal?
Yeah. 9-foot 8-weight is my go-to fly rod. If the wind's not blowing and if I'm throwing a small fly and if I want to be sporty, I'll pull out a 6-weight for the redfish, or if I'm fishing for ladyfish, or if I'm blind casting for ladyfish or blind casting for trout, I'll use the 6-weight. But an 8-weight is, an 8-weight's the go-to rod, 8 or 9-weight. Either one, I prefer the 8-weight. Foot 8-weight. You don't need a reel that holds 200 yards of backing, but you do need 50 or 100 yards of backing, and you need a good solid disc drag, because these fish are strong, and every fish is going to take drag. Even your 3 and 4 pound fish, they're going to take drag. So this is not trout fishing where you just clamp down on it and strip him in, because if you do, the hook will pull out, or you'll break your tippet. I use really heavy tippet. I use 20-pound test leader. I use 1/0 Gamakatsu 12S and SC15 hooks on my flies. I had been using some other brands. I'm not going to say what it is, and I did have trouble with them straightening out because I use heavy tippet. Primarily for abrasion resistance against the weeds and against the oysters. And you can put some heat on these fish. If you're fishing, let's say, in a little flooded grass flat, and you see 3 or 4 fish tailing, 34, maybe 50 or 60 feet away, and you hook a fish right near you, you want to stop that fish, man. You don't want to let him run over there and spook those other 3 or 4 fish. You want to put some heat on him. You want to grab him, let him go, and then you're going to go after the other fish and keep from spooking them. So you put heat on a fish like that with 20-pound tippet, and you need a pretty stout hook, or you're going to straighten it out.
Okay. Now, are you primarily using floating lines? Do you have any need for any other type of line?
I use 90% of the time a floating line and maybe 10% of the time an intermediate sink tip. For the most part, I'm fishing in 12 to 15 inches of water, so we don't need heavy, we don't need sinking lines, and I personally don't like throwing heavy flies. So unless we're fishing in the grass, usually I'll fish flies with big bead chain eyes on them because they're so much easier to throw. We're fishing in the grass. The fish, you got to understand that fish's nose is down on the bottom of the marsh, so that fly's got to get down in front of him so he can see it.
Right.
I got a number of different flies that I've developed.
Before you go on to flies, back to the line. Are there any particular types of lines that you like using? I know there's.
I love the new Orvis Redfish taper.
The reason
I like the Redfish taper is it has a short, heavy head. It loads quickly for quick, short casts. Our casts are rarely over 60 feet. Rarely over 60 feet. And many times they're 30 feet. So, but they got to be fast. I mean, you don't have time to false cast four times and then try to gently lay the fly in front of the fish's nose. I mean, it's a pick it up and put it down, bam, bam, bam. And the redfish lines just load the rod so much more quickly and allow you to do that better. Far and away the best lines for what I do.
Okay, good. And so let's talk about food and flies now. Before you talk about flies, let's talk about the food that's out there that these redfish are eating. What's the primary food sources in your area?
Crabs and minnows.
Crabs and minnows.
Crabs and small fish. They'll eat immature blue crabs, fiddler crabs. There are a number of different small crabs. I don't even know what all the species are that are around the oysters. So that's one of the reasons we fish around the oyster bars for the fish. Food is there. Shrimp. Primary, shrimp, small fish, and crabs. A great shrimp pattern is always, you need some good shrimp patterns. Either an ultra shrimp or a St. Simon scampi or there's some other flies that I use I can't remember the name of right now for the shrimp imitations. And they don't have to be really accurate imitations except possibly for trout because if a redfish wants to eat and you put something that looks alive in front of him, he's going to eat it. Can I digress for a minute? Because I failed to mention a really cool fishery we have here.
Okay, sure.
Can I back up a minute?
Sure. Rewind.
Okay, and I was reminded of this when I started talking about the shrimp imitations. We've got a really cool fishery in April and May and early June in front of Jekyll Island, 1 to 3 miles off the coast, for triple tail. A lot of people have never, ever heard of that fish. It's a big, flat fish that looks like a saltwater bluegill, if you will. It has that same body shape. And if you can imagine a bluegill getting to 12 or 15 or 20 pounds and how hard a fish like that would fight, that's how hard these fish fight. We've got a really unique fishery, and most people think the fish are spawning at this time in front of Jekyll Island, where we simply idle around in front of Jekyll, and these fish are floating on the surface. And we sight cast to them. Many of the captains and a lot of people do this, fish a popping cork with a short leader and a live shrimp, and that's deadly. I tell you, a lot of the captains started releasing a lot of the fish this year too, which was a great thing because they're getting some pressure around here. But I came up with an ultra shrimp pattern that I tie with some of these new UV cured acrylics. And the triple tail is a short striker. Whereas if you're fishing a live shrimp for, let's say, a trout, you hook the shrimp underneath the horn or near the eyes because a trout will strike a shrimp on the eyes. A triple tail strikes a shrimp on the tail. So a lot of times you just get a short strike. So I came up, I developed a fly with a stinger hook for the triple tail. And it just worked marvelously. And it is a real, real good imitation of a shrimp tied with white ultra hair and the UV cure acrylics. There's some pictures of it on my website.
Yeah, I just pulled up a picture of a triple tail.
There you go.
On the web, and yeah, you're right. It looks just like a big old sunfish. Yeah,
it
big,
does.
Tall body. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or a crappie.
You catch one, and they take off on a run, and they jump, and it's not the easiest thing to do on a fly rod, but you've really accomplished something if you pick one up on a fly rod. And you got to have good casting ability. The fish is moving, the boat is moving, the wind is blowing, and you got to put the fly 6 inches in front of the fish's nose, you know, 40 to 50 feet from you. It's not the easiest thing to do, but when you do it, you've really accomplished something. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know where else it exists.
Yeah.
Cool. Where they free float like that.
Yeah. Well, Tim in Illinois asked, he said, please list the seasonal flies, including sizes. So are you fishing crabs and bait fish and shrimp all year round, or do they differ?
Yes, I do. And like I said, I think if you put something that looks alive in front of a redfish and he wants to eat, he's going to eat it. On the grass flats, on the tailing fish, I use the fiddler crab patterns, and they're really suggestive patterns. Size 2 black toad, a size 2 tan toad, a size 2 root beer toad. They all work really, really well. You want the body of the crab as it, and it's a variation of a merkin crab pattern is all it is, but you want the body of the crab to be no bigger than a quarter and probably more the size of a nickel. But you want those flies to be heavily weighted to get down. The purple passion, which is a purple rabbit strip and a black bucktail with some orange and black barred silly legs and copper flash. That works well in a size 2 or a size 4 or even a size 1/0 Gamakatsu 12S. That works all year long in murky water. You know, dark water, dark pattern. Dark water, dark pattern. This is a real dark pattern, so it shows up. And a lot of times we've got murky water here. It works really well. One of the go-to lures for hardware fishermen is a Johnson Gold Spoon. The spoon fly, the Dupree spoon fly, is a great fly to use for redfish. You also catch trout on it. They're a little bit difficult to tie, so I came up with a variation of it. It's called the Chernobyl Flashbang, and it's tied with a Puglisi flash brush and some rabbit strip. And big eyes and a size 2 to a 1/0. A fish head all year long. Last winter, had one instance where there were only mullet on the flats. And every frickin' fly we threw at them, they would reject it. And finally, I tied these mullet flies for tarpon in the fall. When the mullet migration begins, the tarpon will hang at the mouths of like the Hampton River or Gould's Inlet, and they'll feast on the mullet that are being washed out. So I tied it specifically for that, and I'd flat given up on anything else. So I tied that mullet fly on, and lo and behold, we caught a couple of redfish on it. So it just all depends upon what's happening on the flat at that day. But, you know, a shrimp imitation, a St. Simon Scampi, Prawn's Revenge, those are really good shrimp imitations. They work really, really well. Size 4, 2, and 1/0. You just got to keep changing flies until you find something that works that particular day.
What, do you use any topwater patterns? And if so,
occasionally use a gurgler. I find I spook more fish with a topwater pattern than I catch, but if you use a gurgler, you've got to fish it very cautiously because these fish remember in really shallow water and they're going to spook. I would not fish it in the winter in shallow water, but in the summer and on the grass flats, yes. And Kent Edmonds, who is a guide on the Flint River and also an FFF instructor, developed a pattern that he calls the stealth bomber. And that works extremely well down here. And it's more or less a Dahlberg diver tied out of foam. As an aside for the people that live in close to smallmouth waters, in a size 6, it's a deadly smallmouth fly.
Okay. Good. Let's talk about some strategies and tactics now. You do a lot of sight fishing, teach your clients a lot of sight fishing. Is that where you get your best results, is sight fishing, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, because we can use a trolling motor when the tide gets up and blind cast the oyster rakes, and we can catch a fish here and there. Best results, depends upon how you result. I mean, results are catching fish or having a great time and being excited. Having shots at fish and having a great time and getting excited, I would say the results are better when you do the sight fishing. Probably equally as good in terms of catching. I happen to know where the fish hang out, I mean, only because I've spent a lot of time on the water. So I begin we get close to an area, I'll turn the motor off, I'll use the trolling motor until it gets too shallow. I'll pull the trolling motor up and then we start pulling the boat and we start looking for fish. I fish out of a Maverick HPXV and it draws about 8 inches, 8.5 inches fully loaded. I have found that if I'm dragging bottom, typically I'm in water that's too shallow for the fish. I mean, yeah, you'll see fish rolling around in the mud, and you'll see them swimming around in the mud occasionally with their backs out of the water, but for the most part, they're going to be in 10 inches of water or more. So the Maverick gets plenty shallow, but we pull through the flats until many times we're just fishing to wakes and pushes here. Our water, except in the winter, is usually pretty murky and stained. Couple of reasons. I mentioned the mud that comes out of the rivers and also the nutrients and the algae. I mean, it's not like a red tide bloom or anything like that, but our water is murky. So we're looking for a redfish pushing through the flats, and they push a real distinctive bow wake in front of them. So we see the bow wake, or maybe we see the fin of the fish early in the morning if it's slick calm. It's kind of like shooting birds with a shotgun. You got to lead them. They're going to be a foot or two in front of the bow wake. By the time you get your fly in front of them, you got to aim 5 feet in front of where the fish is when you're casting. Because by the time your fly gets there, the fish is going to be, hopefully, the fish and the fly are going to intersect. That's the whole idea. But we do fish on the low tide, particularly, a lot to pushes and wakes.
Okay.
And I think that might be a good time now to talk a little bit about the daily cycle of where these fish are. And talk about the big tides that we have here. I mentioned earlier that we're really far west. I think we're at the same longitude as Columbus, Ohio. And we're at the far western point of the South Atlantic Pike. And we have tides that will go every day 6 to 7 feet. It's not unusual to have 9-foot tidal changes in 6 hours. And the people that live in Florida or up in North Carolina, I mean, 2 and 3 foot of tidal change is a huge tidal change for them. We never have 2 or 3 foot of tidal change. I mean, the least tidal change we have is maybe 5 foot in a 6 hour period. So that moves these fish around. When we've got the high tides, there are different types of spartina grass, and there's spartina, what I call long grass, that grows on the edges of the marshes. And that typically gets flooded every day during this tidal change. So the redfish and the trout, too, migrate up close to the grass and actually swim around the grass, and they disperse on these high tides. I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, with the hundreds of thousands of acres of water that floods, how many bazillion gallons of water run through St. Simon Sound or St. Andrews Sound from the marshes to the oceans twice a day? Just a tremendous amount of water. But the fish on the high tides, they get up and disperse. Now, on the low tides, all of these oyster bars are exposed, and the fish are pushed out of the grass and the edges, and they stay as shallow as they can, but they get into schools even in the summer. They get into schools, not as big as they are in the winter, but you'll have schools of 5 to 20 fish pretty consistently in the summertime. And these fish are schooled up as shallow as they can to stay away from their primary predator, which is the bottlenose dolphin. And if you've ever seen a bottlenose dolphin or a group of bottlenose dolphins, work in a school of redfish on the low tide, it's amazing. I have seen dolphins get on their side and try to swim up onto a mud bank to get after redfish before.
That must be pretty exciting to watch.
It is exciting, but, you know, it's time to go somewhere else because those fish are so scared they're not going to eat for another 5 hours.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, but that's kind of a lifetime experience, I would think, to see that happen.
Well, it happens quite frequently.
Oh, does it? Oh.
You know, yeah, we see flipper around. Typically, we're going to go somewhere else because those fish know flipper's around, and those fish are going to be scared. But so on the low tide, they're bunched up. They stay as shallow as they can. The tide comes in. They move up the flats, kind of like the way bumfish do. It gets up to the edge of the marsh grass. The marsh grass starts flooding. They disperse up into the marsh grass, and they just hang out there. Their whole purpose in life right now, remember, they're immature fish, is to eat and to keep from being eaten.
Yep, get big, huh? Yeah.
And get big so they can go have sex.
Yeah. So how do you said, kind of told us how you find fish. You're just out there looking for wakes and movement and fins and so forth.
Nervous water.
Really, yeah, nervous water. I don't suppose birds play any role in this because we're not talking about bait fish and they're not generally after bait fish too much, are they? That was one of the top
birds,
three.
Birds do and can play a big role, not necessarily, but if you see some birds working a piece of water, you better doggone go investigate it because, you know, a lot of
something's
times these fish
on.
Will have shrimp cornered or something's going on or they're working on something. I've seen the fish just as the tide is going out, I've seen them bunched up at a creek mouth just rolling and slashing as the bait fish are being washed out of there. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. So once you, now before you even are seeing fish, what are you looking for as far as prime sight fishing water? Is it the spartina? Is it marsh grass? When you say marsh grass, is that something different than spartina?
It is a type of spartina grass. They're different species, and I'm not that familiar with exactly what the scientific names are. I'm looking for a gradually sloping shore, preferably with oysters, scattered oysters, or an oyster bank along it that slopes out to some type of mud bank that gradually slopes and then eventually goes off into deeper water. And the spartina grass, where the fish can hide when the tide comes in.
Okay.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of that habitat, and not all of that habitat holds fish.
Okay. And when you say the tide comes in because that brings in bigger fish and dolphins that can feed on the redfish, right? So when you say hide in the grass.
Well, I've seen them feed on the redfish primarily on the low tide when they get flushed out of the grass.
Okay. So you're at risk at all times being a redfish.
Yeah, that's right. You know, as the little crab who's swimming around is at risk at all times.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, people ask me about fishing, and I'm not a hunter, but, you know, about fishing and, you know, herding fish and this and that. And I said, all you have to do is go out to the ocean. And if you think fly fishermen are vicious, go out to the ocean. Look at the fish.
Right.
I mean, it's an eat or be eaten world, period. That's all
exactly
it's about, right?
Right?
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's really vicious out there. But anyway, so when you, okay, so we've identified the kind of water and subsurface terrain that we're looking for. Now you see some fish feeding. How do you approach them? How do you move the boat? What do you tell your client to do?
Very carefully and slowly. You don't want to make any noise on the hull of the boat. You don't want to be knocking around because once the fish know you're there, they're harder and harder to catch. If you can sneak up on a school of fish first thing in the morning before you catch one, I mean, your best shot is going to be your first couple of shots because the fish will figure out you're there after your first couple of shots. They're catchable. They're not terrible. They're harder to catch, but they're catchable as long as they're not really scared. You can tell it's really hard not to bump them. When I say bump them, that's when you run over them. And they leave in a mud puff, and you see a mud puff where they used to be. Or you feel them bumping the bottom of the boat as they run away. And I've had that happen a lot. I mean, we got so many redfish down here, and they're thick, that, you know, and it's inevitable you're going to spook some. And they take off, and you feel them, you feel the thud, 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 thud as their tail bumps the bottom of your boat as they're swimming underneath your boat to get away. But you've got to approach them very carefully, very slowly. Try to stay on the outside of a school. If you see a school, try to stay on the outside of it. Cast to the fish on the edge of it. If you end up bumping fish, there are probably fish 30, 40 feet out that have not been spooked. So by all means, go ahead and cast. Cast beyond the fish that you spooked, particularly if you haven't bumped the school. If that's the first time you bumped the school, you stand a good chance of still catching fish.
When do you know to move on? When do you know that you've got them thoroughly spooked and you need to move on? And how far do you need to move?
Wow. I guess when you get overly frustrated. you just got to know where these fish hang out on the different tidal stages. Where do you move? I mean, you move to your next spot.
But I mean, how far would that be? Would it be, you know, 25 yards?
It could be 100 yards. It could be 2 miles.
Okay.
Usually on a flat, I'll stay on a flat. On some of these flats, they're multiple schools. And if you bump a school or spook a school, just keep on going. You know, just cover new water. And if you're in water that you've got confidence with, you'll run across more fish.
Now, how do you know what they're feeding on, or do you know? Is it by where they're at, or how they're acting? How do you know what fly to put on?
Usually it's the time of year. Like right now, they're beginning to fish. They're beginning to feed on the small shrimp, or white shrimp, or probably an inch and a half, 2 inches long right now. So they're feeding. So you tie on a shrimp imitation a couple of inches long. Later in the fall, when the shrimp are 3 and 4 inches long, you tie on a bigger shrimp imitation. I'd say probably shrimp is the primary forage right now on the low tide. And on the flood tides, when they're tailing, they're up there to eat fiddler crabs. Now,
okay.
That doesn't mean if a shrimp swims by them, it doesn't mean they won't eat it, because certainly they will. I mean, they're on those flats to eat. And if anything edible swims by them, they'll take a swipe at it.
Okay.
I'll go back again. I mean, if they're feeding, I don't think it makes a whole heck of a lot of difference what you put in front of them. If they're not feeding, sometimes these fish just have lockjaw. They won't eat a live shrimp. So they're just not eating. So.
Now, do you?
I don't really think. I mean, I like changing fly patterns. And I like trying to present different fly patterns, but I think if they want to eat, they're going to eat.
Do you present a shrimp and a crab in the same way?
Pretty much. It's a strip, okay. Strip, 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 strip. If you feel that your fly is in front of the fish, you know, just bump it a couple of times, bump, bump, rather than a strip, bump, bump, let it sit, bump, bump, let it sit. You got to kind of watch the fish, particularly if you're feeding fish into tailers. You got to watch the fish and watch his reaction. And
now, do you approach them the same way you would approach a tarpon? In other words, you're trying to pull your fly away from them or 90 degrees
Absolutely.
From them?
Absolutely. Okay. If you've got the fish facing you, and if you can cast, let's say you're to the one side of the fish, if you can catch beyond into the other side of that fish and strip that fly so that it comes into view as if it's swimming away from him, and if he sees it, speed the strip up like it's even faster, he'll charge it. I mean, I've seen him leave bow wakes charging flies before when you can catch them like that. That's the ideal situation. Oncoming, stripping a fly in front of him. That's the ideal situation.
Okay. And then what about bait fish imitations? Do you fish those differently than you do the shrimp and crabs?
Not really. It's a strip, 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 strip.
Same thing,
Just make it look alive.
Okay. What are some of...
I don't really think they're terribly particular if they want to eat.
Okay. It's more the presentation getting on and not spooking them.
More not spooking them. If you can match the size of the fly to what's on the flat at the time, for example, I'll go back to what we talked about last winter. The only thing was 6-inch long mullet. And once we put a 6-inch long fly on there, we started catching fish. But many times a flashy fly will catch a fish, and imitative, doesn't really have to be a real accurate imitation to catch these fish.
Okay.
Just something that looks alive.
What are the most common mistakes you see fly fishers make on the water?
False casting way, way, way too much. If you false cast, if you're in a trout stream and your brown trout is going to rise every time pretty much in the same spot, so you've got a chance to delicately false cast your dry fly 4 or 5 times while you wait for that fish to time the fish, and then you drop it down and he doesn't rise, you pick it up, you false cast 4 or 5 more times and you drop it down in front of him. If you false cast 4 or 5 times before you drop it down, the fish is out of range and he's gone. I mean, it's a pick it up, put it down type of strip. Haul while you're picking it up, give some line, haul forward and shoot line to the fish. That's all you have to do.
The best thing you could do with your time and money before you take a trip down is take some casting lessons and practice, right?
Practice, yeah. The other thing that I see people do, and we all get excited. I mean, if you've got a big fish in front of you, and if you don't get knock-kneed, you don't need to be out there. But people try to place the fly on their final cast. And by that I mean they make a false cast or two, and their loops are good, and their forward false cast is fine. But on their final presentation, they thrust their hand out, they straighten their wrist, and they open their loop, and they kill their loop. And if the wind is blowing at you, the fly is going to blow right back into your face. You need to make that final presentation cast a good tight loop, let the loop unroll, and then drop the fly rod to present the fly to the fish, what Joan Wolf calls the follow through. So many people, when they get excited, don't do that. So many people, instead of stopping the rod on the final presentation, just kind of slow it down rather than an abrupt stop and then a presentation. So,
yeah. Good tips. You know, good final tip for the day on getting those casts. I know how important it was with when I went down tarpon fishing. Same program.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
The way you described,
Oh my gosh, yes.
And you get a shot and your knees are shaking, you get that one shot, and if you blow it, it could be hours again before you get that shot again. So,
Typically, we get a lot of shots. I mean, we'll have, on the low tide, we'll have anywhere from 30 to 50 shots easy.
Mm.
And on the flood tides, on the good days, you'll get shots of 10 to 20 fish. On the bad days, 3 to 5.
Yeah, good.
You know, sometimes 40 shots on the good days.
Well, David, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up here. We've run out of time. But
time
flies. Stick with me. Yeah.
Okay.
Stick with me here. We're going to give some good stuff away here, and I could use your help in doing that. And we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which I know you're a big part of. And a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also a copy of Saltwater Fly Fishing from Maine to Texas, courtesy of Amato Books. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back, and we'll do those giveaways. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's www.inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes for the winners of our drawings, which are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you haven't registered for that yet, do so now, or you're going to miss out because we're going to draw this in about 2 seconds. So in the future, try to get your registration in ahead of time, and then you'll have a chance at some of these great prizes. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you can learn about all their activities and get involved in the organization. And our winner for that is Anthony, looks like Scotto, and Anthony's in California. So, Anthony, congratulations. Sorry if I destroyed your name, but you're the winner of that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you already have a membership, let me know, and we'll see if we can't get that extended for you. Now we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which is courtesy of Amato Books. You can learn more about Amato at amatobooks.com. And our winner there is Christopher Martino. Christopher Martino in New Jersey. Just writing his name down here, Christopher Martino. Congrats, Christopher, and I know you'll enjoy that Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And lastly, we're going to give away a copy of Saltwater Fly Fishing from Maine to Texas, courtesy of Amato Books at amatobooks.com. And the way we do this is I ask a question about something we've talked about tonight, and David can help me make sure that I get the right answer on these things. This is kind of a two-part question. When is one of David's favorite times to fish for redfish? What kind of tide is it? And what is in the water where he's fishing when he fishes this kind of tide? So the type of tide and the type of structure that he might find during these flood tides that he doesn't normally get to find. So that's my question, a little two-part question. And so, David, I'm waiting for somebody to give me an answer here online and see if we can stir their mind a bit, see who's taking notes. Okay, first answer, and that's not quite what I was looking for, low tide flats. That's not really what I was looking for. There's a specific kind of tide and a specific kind of, I'll give a better hint, vegetation that tide goes into. Okay, this was low tide crabs and oysters. And it's not a low tide. Both of these guys said low tide. Am I correct, David? David? Oh, I lost David, I guess. I'll keep trying here and see what you guys have to give me. Hope you guys can hear me. I lost David. Looks like you guys are still online. There we go. Silas, you hit it right on the money. It's the flood tide with the spartina grass. So we talked about that a lot with the flood tides coming in, filling the spartina grass, and that's one of the times that were David's favorite time for fishing for redfish. So, Silas in Joplin, Missouri, that was great. You just won yourself a copy of Saltwater Fly Fishing from Maine to Texas. So, Silas, please send me your mailing address. You can do so in the same text box, and we will get that sent out to you, or send your address to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So, congratulations on that. I guess that might have been a little harder than I thought it was going to be. But you hit it spot on. So thanks for playing, Silas, and congratulations. So, David, are you back with us? Nope, we must have lost David. Well, I want to thank him for being on the show with us tonight. It was a pleasure talking with him, and I want to thank him for sharing his time with us. And certainly knows his backyard there in southern Georgia, which sounds like an incredible place to visit. So, folks, hopefully you found the archive on our website. If you haven't, go out and search around. Go search for redfish. Search the archive. We've got several shows on redfish in different parts of the country, and by the time you listen to all of our shows, you ought to be an expert in redfish. And for sure, you know, we've got over 160 shows, I believe, now. Go ahead and search for about anything you want, location, types of fishing, whatever, and there's tons of things to learn. Our next broadcast will be on August 7th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we're going to interview Gary Borger. And our topic for the show will be Angler as a Predator. And Gary's going to explore the angler as a predator. As successful fly fishers, we need to play the role of the predator, focusing closely on the fish's ability to sense its environment. And so what kind of predator are you? Why don't you join us and find out? And this is an extension of one of Gary's latest books in his series of books, which are incredible, as we as predators in the fly fishing world. So he's just releasing that book. In fact, it's just, I think, came out this week. So that'll be a fun one to do with Gary. They always are. He's a great guest to interview. I'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, King's Fly Shop, Royal Gordon Anglers, Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.